welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown, and today we'll be hearing from Robert Horwitz, who's the author of the very new America's Right, Anti-Establishment Conservatism, From Goldwater to the Tea Party. Robert, how are you doing?
Fine. Thank you very much, and happy to be with you.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. Real pleasure to have read the book. I've had the chance to interview recently a couple of other people who were writing on the subject, and your take, I thought, was really interesting. I gather that part of that is because of some of your varied background and where you are now and where you've been. I wonder if you could talk a little bit about yourself, just about, you know, what your writing past is all about. Looks like you've done a lot of writing on regulatory reform and sort of how that informs your approach to this book that you've just published.
Sure. I was trained as a sociologist, got a PhD from Brandeis University, and I wrote a dissertation on the rise of regulatory agencies and regulatory control in the United States and why deregulation happened. And so it was a general topic I alighted on, for the most part, on communications and particularly the deregulation of broadcasting. So my initial interest in that is that here we had a regulatory agency that had been certainly criticized, but, you know, in large part successful for about 60 years, the Federal Communications Commission. And when I was a graduate student, I noticed that, you know, all these regulations were beginning to be taken away, and tried to understand how and why that happened. And after, you may not remember this, but the early 1980s, when I got my degree, a very bad time in the academic job market, and I got a job not in a sociology department, but in a communication department because of the focus on communication industry and government policy issues. And when I was in my new job for the first few years trying to figure out what to do with the dissertation, the topic expanded from just broadcasting to telecommunications, particularly the breakup of the phone company and the deregulation of what we call common carrier communications.
Yeah, and this background is really shows up in this book, not in the specifics, but I think in your take on the subject matter. Let's talk about the book, and in doing so, let's maybe just start with the title and some definitions, because when we get into talking about the Tea Party, it seems to me definitions matter a lot. So in your title, you refer to anti-establishment conservatism. I wonder if you can define this for us, how you use the term, and particularly as it relates to other forms of conservatism. I know that you've done some work in other countries, and so both in the U.S., but also how that, you know, terminology differs from the way it's used elsewhere in the world.
You know, conservatism is a major theoretical tradition, a major political orientation that changes over time. It has a great many constituent parts, and so there are various kinds of conservatism that appear in American history. And the pre-World War II conservatives, or the right wing, is rather different from the post-World War II conservatism, which is itself also different from the current one. So the definition that I gave, anti-establishment conservatism, really was a way of putting a label on a variation of conservatism, of a wing of the American right that emerged after World War II, that split with the pre-World War II isolationism of the right. That split with the isolationism of the pre-war right to embrace the fight against the international communist foe. And the reason why I talk about it as anti-establishment conservatism is that that was very much a break from what we understand as establishment conservatism, the sort of Eisenhower moderate Republican Party that, for the most part, accepted the New Deal and state intervention into the economy, although it's critical of it, and accepted Truman's containment policy. The anti-establishment conservatives were the wing of the right that wanted to take the fight to the communist foe directly, were very unhappy with containment policy and with their Republican establishment moderate contemporary. And they also wanted to overturn or repeal the New Deal. So anti-establishment conservatism is this term that I'm giving to the wing of the conservative American right founded in William F. Buckley's National Review and found its real strength with the 1964 candidacy of Barry Goldwater.
Let's place ourselves into that time period. You start with Goldwater and we'll move ahead soon, but let's place ourselves there and also talk about another term that you use, which is fusionism. Where do we get this and who coined the term and why is it an important term to understand that time period in the Goldwater period?
Okay, fusionism, as I remember, is really a term from George Nash's classic work on American conservatism. And it's a way of trying to understand this combination of a kind of traditional, often Christian orientation toward the world and a worldview and libertarianism that would seem to be quite opposite of each other. But fusionism and Buckley's genius was to keep those tendencies together in a political coalition that opposed establishment conservatism, the sort of moderate Northeast Republican model of that.
And you talk a lot both about the ideas but also their implementation. And so one of the big intellectual pieces of this time period is the road to serfdom. You really can't leave that out of this discussion. But that book was, as you presented, is not just an intellectual exercise. There were institutions and publicity connected to its publication. So, and you talk about this, I think, in some interesting ways. So how did the general public come to read Hayek's work? How did this go from simply a intellectual debate to much more of a movement that involves the public in ways that other intellectual debates often don't?
Right. You know, if you read Hayek's book, it's not that easygoing. But it was popularized in various forms. It was abridged, and an abridged edition was sold and marketed by Reader's Digest, sent to everybody who was a subscriber to Reader's Digest. It was even made into a cartoon book, you know, what we now call illustrated novels, but essentially a kind of cartoon version of Hayek's book. And it was very explicitly financed and distributed by the sort of anti-establishment conservative establishment. I realize it's a sort of contradiction in terms, but those people who were bent on pushing Hayek used almost every lever of the media empire to get that book out there. And it did. It had it had wide recognition, for a book that was written, you know, for an intellectual audience by an economist. It was quite extraordinary. And then the other side of that, Ayn Rand's books, her novels, were also, extremely popular, you know, when they were published in the 50s. And have continued to be so.
And who else is involved here? What are some of these other institutions? Because you talk about some of the anti-establishment entrepreneurs,
yes,
who were active during this time period. So there are many, but who are some of the notable ones? And And where did they work during this time period, during the 1960s and during the 1970s?
Many of them came up through the Goldwater campaign. Probably the most important was Phyllis Schlafly, whose book, A Choice Not an Echo, was in effect a campaign book that mirrored Goldwater's book, and had very wide distribution. It was very easy to read, short, punchy, very critical of, you know, establishment political figures, and pushing Goldwater as this alternative. One account that I read showed that that book had something like 3 to 3.5 million copies out there around the 1964 election. Now, and the other people who were important there, who became very important conservative political entrepreneurs later, were people like Paul Weyrich, people like Richard Viguerie, many of whom had developed very competent experience in media and in certain kinds of, what was it called, you know, Viguerie had the sort of blanking
direct
mail stuff. A lot of that was developed in and around the Goldwater campaign. Now, those folks who had been quite prominent, you know, as sort of mid-level operatives during the Goldwater campaign were pretty much purged from the GOP leadership after Goldwater's campaign fizzled so badly. And those were some of the people who, in effect, I'd say went underground, or at least underground from the Republican political establishment, to put together some of the early, help put together think tanks, put together the networks that brought funders into those things. And they became extremely important in the mid-1970s when Jimmy Carter's presidency began to founder, and when the kinds of opposition to the liberal democratic establishment, particularly among Christian Protestant evangelicals, was beginning to take hold.
Right, and though the irony is the position that you describe Carter playing in inviting the social conservative movement into national politics. I recently interviewed Michael Lind for the podcast, someone that you quote in your book, and he referred to Jimmy Carter as the first major economic neoliberal policymaker, more significant than Friedman and certainly preceding Reagan. You seem to make a similar link to Carter and social conservatism. How does President Carter fit into this story about the right wing, a story that we might not normally include him in?
Right. So, you know, Carter was vilified by the right. On the other hand, you know, when he started running for office, you know, in the election against President Ford, he came out as an evangelical. He tried to tap his evangelical roots and practice as a way of distinguishing himself from normal politicians, and particularly the legacy of Richard Nixon and Nixon's private sinning. And Carter called upon his evangelical roots to say, you know, I will not lie to you. I am a man of the church. I believe in Jesus. And even though Carter was in many respects, you know, a conventional liberal Democrat, although in this period of time that was hard to do, he also opened that door for bringing in evangelicals, people who talked about their born-again beliefs, into the public eye. And, of course, there was some big conference on the family that Carter put together, and a lot of evangelicals came to that, and that was one of those moments in Carter's presidency where the conflicts between religious conservatives and other kinds of social liberals really clash, particularly around the family, because all of those traditional notions of what the family is, what sex practices should be, the evil of abortion, all came to a head during that conference on the family. I can't remember what date it was, 1978 perhaps.
You know, in the interest of time, we're not going to be able to cover everything, and so I want to fast forward a little bit, because a good portion of the book and a good portion of your contribution is to use this foundation to think and talk about the Tea Party. So let's talk about that in that part of the book. You connect what has been called the paranoid style to the Tea Party movement of the last, say, 5 years or so. Where does this style come from, and how does it relate to the Tea Party as we know it?
Well, you know, the paranoid style is this phrase that comes from the great historian Richard Hofstadter, who wrote about McCarthyism and the campaign around Goldwater and tried to figure out, you know, who are these people and what is that kind of enraged sensibility of feeling discriminated against, of vamped on by the evil government forces. And so one of the things that I found interesting was, as the Tea Party began to build momentum, as it begins in 2009, in reaction to the election of President Obama and the TARP and the stimulus package, various kinds of similar behavior and enraged sensibility began to be noted by a lot of people, normal journalists, academics, and the like. And so people started resurrecting Hofstadter and Hofstadter's notions of the paranoid style and status anxiety when trying to understand the kinds of rhetorical excess and flights of fancy and departure from fact that the Tea Party was engaging in. You know, as I try to say in the book, it's one thing to talk about and open a discussion about the evils of taxation and the evils of too much government spending and the problem of experts running our lives. And it's quite another to then move into notions that, you know, President Obama is secretly a Muslim, that he has no birth certificate in the United States, that he's secretly a Kenyan socialist bent on destroying American industry, and the whole birther phenomenon, which is very connected to much of the Tea Party and the Tea Party's rhetoric, is emblematic of what people talk about the paranoid style of American politics.
So much of there are these connections and these overlaps and similarities, but a lot has changed since the time of Goldwater, and a lot of that has been related to how politics works. Ideas can stay the same, but the mechanics of politics changes. I wonder if you've, and you didn't deal with this a lot in the book, but given your background in communications, I wonder if you've thought very much about some of the differences in how these messages that may be very similar to those that were shared 40 years ago, how they have connected the ways in which they have been disseminated, and how that relates to the significance of the Tea Party today versus the Goldwater wing of the Republican Party in the 1960s.
I think a couple of things there. One, going back to some of my old communication work, the deregulation of American communications had certain kinds of consequences, one of which is simply to open up the field to different voices that had been pretty much kept out. So politically charged rhetoric had been kept out of mainstream media by things like the Fairness Doctrine, the kinds of public trustee model of broadcasting. once broadcasting was deregulated and cable grew and all of these new outlets opened up, then especially the right wing realized there were places for them to go. And they created certain kinds of media empires, and it wasn't just Fox News or Rush Limbaugh talk radio, but there's a long tradition that grew very rapidly in the 1970s of religious broadcasting, particularly right-wing religious broadcasting of a fundamentalist or heavily evangelical nature. And though there's a big debate about whether there's a silo effect, whether there's an echo chamber, it's certainly possible now for people of particular political proclivities or any kind of interest group to basically keep themselves in a particular kind of communication silo where they may read the National Review with their intellectuals, they watch Fox News, they may listen to Rush Limbaugh, they go to those kinds of websites, and competing arguments are basically already massaged in a way that they're considered illegitimate. Now, and I'm not saying that that conservatives do this only, liberals do it as well. The very choice of much media now creates the possibility of creating your own little private or delimited kind of media system.
Yeah, I think that's very much one of the reasons why a book like yours is important and useful and so very interesting. I mentioned at the start how much I enjoyed this, and I really do think it's a very nice contribution to this growing and very recent literature on the Tea Party and on its various connections to the past and various connections to things that are going on today.
Thank you.
What's next for you? Do you have another project connected to this one, or is there something else on your desk? What do we have to look forward to from you?
Yeah, it's interesting. I tend to do I like doing one big project at a time. There are scholars that have 3-4 projects floating around. I don't, and so I'm kind of poking around. But there was a chapter that didn't make it to the book. Polity Press wanted the book to be short and sweet, and I think they've made the right decision about that. But I became very intrigued with the role of Reinhold Niebuhr, the mid-century Protestant theologian, often considered in Christian circles of a kind of theological conservative, but he was very much a political liberal. And there was, way prior to when Jerry Falwell became a national figure, there were people like Reinhold Niebuhr from the mainline Protestant movement who was very influential. And just as there's been a resurrection of Richard Hofstadter and the paranoid style in American politics perspective when you had the rise of Obama and the Tea Party together, there's also been a rise or a resurrection of Reinhold Niebuhr, and I'm curious to how that happened and why that happened. And so I started to read a lot more Niebuhr and commentaries on Niebuhr, seeing if I can scope that out.
Well, I hope when that book turns into a book, you come back with it. I think as Polity has made some very good choices with your most recent one. It is short, sweet, but full of a lot of very interesting information. Again, the title, America's Right, Anti-Establishment Conservatism, From Goldwater to the Tea Party, published by Polity Press, from Robert Horowitz. Robert, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. It's been a pleasure. Very nice to talk to you.